Goddard Reel 10. During this meeting you had with Trenchard, were there any other incidents that occurred during it which gave you any impression of what kind of chap he was?
Well, I knew that Trenchard was commanding the Royal Flying Corps and that a great battle had just begun and that he must have many anxieties and preoccupations. But he came from his desk and talked to us in a friendly, fatherly way. I was evidently rather astonished to find what young boys we were. I was all of 18. I think I'd had my birthday about 4 months before. And I didn't feel all that young, but I think that he looked at us so as though we were much too young for the job. But after a while, when he looked at me for quite a while, without saying anything, not unkindly, he then put on his rather more brusque and military attitude and said, "Young man, you want your hair cut." And that is all I remember saying to me personally, because my senior officer was a sub-lieutenant of, a year senior to me, and he was the man to whom to give instructions.
Yes. Now, the operations for which you had been sent out didn't get underway, I believe, and in place of them, you did some general night reconnaissance operations. Could you tell me roughly what those operations involved?
Well, as there were apparently no agents to be dropped or available at that time, we were asked to get to know the enemy country on the other side of the lines as the best we could without endangering the ship and excessively, and we were given night tasks of studying the enemy movements by night, because already the Germans were careful to make their strategic moves and their major movements by rail and by road at night. And this was known so that they shouldn't be detected by reconnaissance from the air in the daytime. And it was known also that we didn't do reconnaissance at night in those days. But so efficient were they that, in fact, I don't think very much was ever seen at night. I mean, rail movements were seen from time to time, and by gently coming down, sometimes through the clouds, transport movements even were seen, and sufficient on a clear moonlight night to see long trains of transport moving from somewhere to somewhere else. But they weren't under sufficient observation for long enough to know precisely their significance, nor were the observations sufficiently regular night by night or throughout the night to give a clear picture of any strategic intentions. So my own personal opinion was that not very much was being achieved.
I believe that it was some little while after you'd started these reconnaissance operations that you actually did any operational flying yourself. Why was there a delay? Why did Chambers monopolize these?
Chambers was, he was a splendid, quiet officer who very seldom said anything. He was a pretty uncommunicative in a way. One could feel his friendliness without him expressing it, but he nevertheless was very much the commanding officer, and I didn't intrude into his thoughts unless I was asked a question. But I did ask him after I'd been there some weeks, and as a matter of fact, we hadn't been doing anything but night reconnaissance, and it hadn't seemed to me to be very important, because that's what we weren't... I mean, we hadn't gone to France to do that. But after a while, I noticed that instead of sharing the flying as we were originally intended to do, he had done all the flying over the lines, and I had done the test flying and the practice flying and flying to England and that sort of thing on the safe side. So I came to the conclusion that he was probably trying to protect me in some way, and I said to him, "How come that I'm not given any of these night reconnaissance jobs?" And he said, "Oh, well, Trenchard gives his orders to me and expects me to do it." And I wasn't satisfied with that. And he said, "Well, Trenchard doesn't think you're a pilot." And I said, "Oh, why was that?" He said, "Well, he noticed that you weren't wearing birds, the albatross, the gold albatross, on your sleeves above your new gold stripes." And I said, "Oh, well, you know perfectly well that I'm as much a pilot as you or anybody else." but that I had got a new naval uniform when I went to see trenches, and it didn't have the albatross birds on it. In fact, privately, I didn't have to say this. He knew that I was darn proud of having been promoted recently to be an acting sub-lieutenant, Royal Navy, and not RNAS, that I was rather proud of the fact and wanted other people to know that I wasn't just a naval air service chap, but I was a real, genuine naval officer.
I find this slightly curious. You had at this stage been in the Naval Air Service for about a year, perhaps a little more, yet your sense of identification was with the regular Navy, and it appears not with the RNAS.
Yes, well, when you've been indoctrinated to be a naval officer since the age of 12, as I was, and had been under naval discipline and had then finally come to commissioned rank in the Navy, you wouldn't likely give away your claim to being a full-blown naval sub-lieutenant and not a newly from school sub-lieutenant RNAS. I know this is a childish thing, but then I was rather childish. I was only 18 years of age.
It also seems to imply, if your attitude was typical and not just peculiar to you, that the RNAS didn't, at this stage, have much of a sense of its own identity.
No, I would say that that was so. Those who wore the broad executive stripe, and not the, we didn't so much mind the Wavy Navy, who held the administrative positions in the Royal Naval Air Service, but all the pilots, those who were trained even to be kite balloon pilots and so forth, wore what was the executive curl and the flat, straight stripe of a naval officer. And we thought this was a bit much, because we were, as it were, we were a closed shop. You see, we were proud of the fact that the Navy had never allowed anybody else to wear the broad stripe and the curl until this RNAS came along. And it's quite true. We didn't really respect the naval types, so-called naval types, who were not naval at all.
Fine. Going back to the purpose of your posting to France, this spy-dropping project, how do you account for the fact that, in fact, none ever took place, as far as you were concerned?
Well, we thought that there must be some strategic reasons, or that they were otherwise employed, or that there weren't many of them anyway. And it wasn't until after we'd been disappointed and delayed and nothing said for quite a long time that the question was asked. The answer was, and I think Chambers asked the question when he went to RFC headquarters, was that until fairly recently, the spies had been dropped, or agents as they were called, had been dropped from aeroplanes by parachute at dusk or at dawn, so that the aircraft could get back before visibility was too good, or they had been dropped in circumstances where the aeroplane would get away safely, and moreover, the agent dropped would not be intercepted on the ground. And they had been pretty successful in having very low casualty rate amongst these brave men, because when they had gathered their information, they came back through the northern frontiers of Germany, through Denmark or through Holland or through Belgium, and got away by sea back to England and debriefed themselves on what they had seen. But the Germans, aware of this, had erected an unclimbable electric protected fence the whole of the width of their frontier from Prussia to Belgium, so that this route of escape was no longer available. And this had happened, I think, just before we got to France, or a little while before we got to France. And the consequence was that spies were not inclined to do this job at all. And they had shown reluctance to be dropped out in parachutes. And finally, after several displays of reluctance and refusal to get out, so we were told, or so Chambers was told, one of the RFC pilots, showing a bit of extra acumen, did a slow roll and dropped his agent out, who had refused hitherto to jump out, and he wasn't strapped in, and so he fell out, parachute and all, because in those days the parachute was attached, as it is now, to the man himself. And so he, this pilot came back and reported how he had done it. And this, the news of this seemed to filter through the intelligence service into the minds of agents. And anyway, this was cited as a reason for them not wishing to be employed. Another reason given was that at that time Zeppelins were being shot down in flames and were appearing in large features over a period of a number of days in our newspapers. And being shot down in flames was one of the things which people didn't aspire to have happened to them in an airship.
So this would have made your own particular operations less attractive to any prospective agents.
The combination of the electric fence and the idea of being picked up by an airship, which might or might not find you at night and might then be shot down in flames, was the sort of thing that these brave men said, well, we're prepared to go on espionage, but we're not prepared to be fried.
Can we revert again to the actual operational flights? What strikes me is that a large and relatively slow-moving craft like an SS airship might have been highly vulnerable to the capacity of firepower that was available on the enemy side of the lines. Well, what were your actual experiences during these flights?
Well, I suppose, although we didn't speak of it, that we were aware that we were doing something that was highly dangerous, and that at any time we could be shot down in flames like Zeppelins were being shot down in England. And I know that our parents, who knew vaguely what we were up to, were extremely scared for us, and so on. And I think that headquarters were also of this impression, and one or two of the RFC pilots, one or two of the RFC observers we had attached to us had said that they would prefer to fly in aeroplanes, and one of them we sent back because we did feel that he was very much averse from this kind of activity. And another rather elderly observer we had, who was a very fine fellow, we employed him on the ground for administrative duties, which relieved me of doing a lot of army things that I didn't understand. Well, I did feel that after a while that it was any date now that that ship would be shot down, not so much from the enemy, but from the French and our own guns, because we noticed, that, or at least I noticed, and so did the crew on board, although I wasn't doing much flying then, that at night people would open fire on at us sporadically in various positions if we happened to be seen. And we came back with rifle bullets in our envelope, which we had to patch, and anti-aircraft guns would also fire at us.
When you say people and anti-aircraft guns, whose are we talking about?
Well, we didn't know whether they were the Frenchmen with the shotgun or with soldiers with rifles, but I think it was mainly soldiers with rifles, and also anti-aircraft guns from time to time did open fire at us if they saw us.
You're talking about the Allied side of the line.
The Allied side of the line, yes, on our own side. But on the enemy side, there was no record of it ever being fired at all, and no flashes indicating. Of course, we were at 13,000 feet on their side of the line, and so we wouldn't have heard anything, but you would have seen the flash of guns, probably, if anybody had been firing. And certainly we would never heard the screech of a bullet going near the ship. So after a while, we decided that the Germans didn't much fire at us or didn't see us at that height, whereas for some reason or other, on our side of the lines, we were seen. And so Chambers, who was doing most of the flying over the lines, in fact, all of it to begin with, he would bring the ship down. As soon as he'd crossed where he thought our lines were, he would spiral down as quickly as he could to a low height and fly back to base at a very low height, probably not more than 200 or 300 feet, with the engine throttled back. And he and his observer would spend their whole time singing at the top of their voices songs which were well known to British troops. I could name none of them. Bollocky Bill the Sailor, and I can't now think them straight away, but there was a number of songs which were well known to the troops, which they sang. And this really did disclose the fact that it was an English airship.
So your experience was that in flying over the German lines, you were subjected to no hostile anti-aircraft fire at all, whereas over your own lines, where you would expect to be safe, you were indeed the target of gunfire from time to time. Was there any explanation of this?
Well, there was no explanation at the time except the additional height that we normally had over the German lines. We were flying at maximum height. But after the war, there was a complete explanation of it, because the Germans themselves had shot down four or five, perhaps more, of their own Zeppelins with their own gunfire. And so they had issued most stringent orders that in no circumstances should any airship of any kind ever be shot at night or over their territory. And consequently, we were, though we didn't know it, really safer there than anywhere else.